As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Harm, our second VanCast of the week. We did a live room. Drance bumped you, right? Because normally we do this show on Monday whenever possible, and now that there's no NHL games for the Canucks, it's definitely possible, but Drance reflexed, right? And he said, no, we're doing the live room Monday after the management and coaching discussion, so we had to wait until Wednesday, which generally means the best for last. I hope you're okay with waiting.
Well, it's my punishment for jumping early in the queue on Monday, forgetting how press conferences work, and just... like asking my questions instead of supposed to wait for the mic.
Let's paint the picture for the VIPs. You know, we're about probably 20 minutes into the press conference, right? So it's not like Harm has needed time to figure out the protocol here. So there's a guy with a boom mic, and he waits for you to kind of wave at him, and so he can get your questions recorded. And generally, people ask two questions, and Harm's waiting his turn, but then he asks, and then later on, he just decides to jump back in. Patrick Johnson was waiting for the mic, or somebody else was waiting for the mic, and all of a sudden, Harm just jumped in and went with it. So, you know, you are no longer a young, aspiring member of the local media. Like, you were just the man that you could just say, nope. Like, you'd literally have Ben Kuzma status. That would be a Kuz thing, and you just did a Kuz thing.
No, I really felt bad because I thought I saw people jumping in without, like, I guess I just wasn't paying close enough attention before sort of waving to the boom mic. So I figured, oh, I guess it's just more of an open thing. It's too used to scrums, man. I'm too used to scrums. I'm scarred from all the scrums in the past where you wait and you wait and you wait to ask your question. And then I'm just like, oh, it's too late for me to ask whatever I needed to. so I went too far in the other direction, but yeah, now I remember. Rookie mistake.
Yeah, and we do get to dive back into that a little bit here because I do want to get your thoughts on a number of areas. Also, in The Athletic online edition, you've also done your report cards, so we will talk a little bit about that. I wanted to lead with Leafs and Oilers losing game one, but, you know, I guess we'll wait on that. You know, our producer, Jeff DeMet, is just shaking his head, and, you know, Drancer is probably in mourning right now, but we will get to that. And what we're really excited about is Ryan Johnson is going to join us a little bit later today. He, of course, is the general manager of the Abbotsford Canucks and, you know, has an ever-increasing portfolio within the Canucks organization. And the Abbotsford Canucks begin their first-round playoff series against Bakersfield tonight at the Abbotsford Center. Games 2 and 3 will be Wednesday and Sunday. Again, game 3 if that's needed. Last year, this team was swept by Bakersfield. They're obviously hoping for a better outcome. They were 3-1 against Bakersfield this year during the regular season. So we'll see if that translates to anything in the playoffs. But home ice generally means you've had the better season and might have more expectations going into this. So we're looking forward to that conversation with Ryan. And at some point, yes, there will be lessons on microphone etiquette in press conferences. One thing I've learned about Canuck Twitter in all of this is that Canucks Twitter really loves it when you go hard at management and potentially ownership every coaching change when we get a chance to talk to the owner, which seems to have been more frequently in the last couple of years. But they certainly hate it when you say anything negative or put players in an uncomfortable position, right? Because far be it for me to ask JT Miller and Elias Pettersson about their relationship. Now, everybody took that as negative and a shot. The reality is those were actual talking points all season. You know, if you remember the sit down beachside with Elliot Friedman and Jeff Merrick during the All-Star break, Pettersson talked about the relationship not being perfect. Other times during the season, JT Miller said the same, that, you know, we've got things to work on and so on. So I thought it'd be interesting to get their response together. No, and if you saw the way I asked the question, I did ask it and kind of led it in a way for them to say how much better it's gotten. Do you know what I mean? Like the question, while it was awkward because the two of them were together and there had to be a premise behind it, there was no expectation that one would take a shot at the other, right? Like, that's silly. And the fact that Pettersson said great and Miller wanted it kind of clarified just because he was jabbing, right, and bobbing and weaving, that everybody on Canucks Twitter decided this was cringy and this was me trying to stir shit for clicks, which it wasn't, right? I just thought it was a unique opportunity to get the two of them together. We don't get that in the locker room setting. And again, the question was framed in a way that would allow them to spin it forward positively, which they were going to do anyway, right? No one was expecting to stir the shit. But of course, that percentage of Canuck Twitter, which are idiots, and most of whom have been muted on my feed, come back with how cringy and you should retire and how dare you ask such a question, because they want you to shit on management. They just want to protect their little players.
Well, yeah, I mean, I thought it was a fair question. And like you said, it was an environment for them to be able to sort of emphasize how much it's improved and sort of put the narrative to bed. Right. And that's exactly what's happened in the aftermath of that. Like, now you've gotten the clarity and, yeah, I mean, I didn't have a problem with the question at all, and again, now the narrative's in the bed.
Yeah, nor did actual journalists. But hey, let's talk a bit about their relationship real quick. And we're going to get into management talk more just because Monday was more recent. How much do you think the removal of Bo Horvat, and you know me, I'm a Bo Horvat fan, so this is not me saying Horvat was the problem. And certainly with the Canucks' success, people are now taking it as Horvat was the problem. And certainly that any logical person would know the other reasons for their success, primarily schedule and goaltending. And certainly the structure's been better, but any thought that Horvat was a problem is insanity. But Horvat was a buffer, right? Now, this is just opinion right now. We're talking opinion. So how much do you think removing that buffer, who happened to wear the C and happened to be the elder statesman in the organization, even though he's not that old, but has certainly been here the longest, how much do you think, you know, and I don't want to frame it that Petey didn't like Miller and Petey went to Bo to say, I don't like what he's doing, do something. Or Miller went to Bo and said, I don't like what Forty's doing, go do something. I'm not suggesting that that's how things were playing out. But nonetheless, one was designated the leader. So removing said designated leader, how do you think it impacted the relationship between Miller and Pettersson, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know definitively, but my initial guess would be, or thought would be, you know, I didn't necessarily think that it would have a significant impact. I just think it's a case where, like Miller said, you enter, especially earlier in their Canucks careers, you enter in an environment and they're just opposite personalities, right? Pettersson's quieter, more reserved. JT is obviously a lot more abrasive, in your face, high energy, and like JT said, they're nothing alike, right? And so it makes sense in that capacity why it would take sort of time for them to develop comfort with each other, develop that positive working relationship. It's also Not everybody needs to be best friends on a team, right? As long as everybody's pulling on the same rope, which they clearly are now, that's really all that that matters. And we know from, I mean, even on cup winning teams, not everybody is best friends and hanging out away from the rink, and that's totally fine. And I think they've obviously gotten to a point now where they feel a lot more comfortable with each other, and that's great.
And I do think though that having to deal with each other more in the top dog capacity. And certainly, you know, we know that Pettersson and Hughes have always been the best two players in the team in the last couple of years, right? And Miller's certainly been good, and Horvat was great this year. But having Horvat removed from the leadership group, and now they've all got to be the central focus of it, because now there is no C. There's a bunch of A's, and potentially at some point down the road, the C will be decided amongst those three. But I do think that it changes the dynamic, that now not everybody can look at Bo, right? Figuratively, literally, and optically, it's now they're all looking at you, and it does change the dynamic a little bit. And, you know, it's not that they've got to talk more or whatever, but now it's kind of on them. Leadership is now on them a little bit more, because we certainly know when Travis Green attempted to give leadership to Pettersson and Hughes 2 years earlier, they weren't ready and it didn't go well. And now they were ready for a bit more, and Miller was ready for a bit more. And maybe at that point, things started to blend a little better. Opinion. Speculation, not reporting. So again, you know, we'll see. But it certainly seemed that as they were having a little more success in all of it, that there just was a little bit better of a mesh going forward. Let's talk a bit about some of the other things that came out of that presser. And one was no buyouts. You know, for me, that was one of my biggest takeaways, because early in the year, we did hear from Jim Rutherford that was the expectation. I've certainly reported for a number of weeks now that I did not expect a buyout in the Oliver Ekman-Larsson situation. But now Patrick Alvin reiterated he's not expecting any buyouts. Surprised?
Well, I mean, a little bit in terms of like relative to obviously what we heard from Rutherford in January, for example, where he said that would be a possibility to turn to if they didn't sort of have alternative avenues to clear cap space, especially since they seem to have more of a focus and emphasis on next season. And certainly in the past, they haven't worried about sort of adding dead cap or long-term consequences of cap decisions if it benefits them in the short term. And having said that, I honestly prefer that they do not buy guys like OEL out, because like Alvin alluded to, you're just creating pain down the line in the years where you're actually hoping that if things go well, you'd be competing for a Stanley Cup. Like, that to me is sort of nonsensical. In the case of OEL, for sure, you buy him out, you get $7 million in cap space this offseason. That could help you significantly add another top four defender, make a run for the playoffs. But what's the point? You're not competing for the cup next year. Next year's supposed to be a building season to hopefully make the playoffs and just start to get the trajectory headed in the right direction. This is going to be a multi-year process. It's not going to be an overnight fix. And while you get the immediate relief, again, you're going to harm yourself down the road. So it is, in my opinion, better for them not to buy guys out. But of course, the consequence of that is you're going to have less wiggle room to work with. And honestly, hearing Alvin speak on Monday, he sounded like a general manager that was realistic about the limited flexibility he has about, for instance, in discussing the roster needs, he only picked out third line center, right? And when the topic of the blue line came up, he sort of referenced all the guys in Abbotsford and Johansson and all of the internal options that they have. It wasn't as if he name checked like, you know, three, four different needs that he wanted to fix on the roster, even shot down sort of signing a veteran backup goaltender. So to me, that signals a general manager who understands that, okay, we're not going to have like a lot of cap flexibility to work with. We may not, you know, we'd like to improve the back end and center ice, but realistically, we may only be able to make one sort of big splash there. And to me, it sounded like a general manager who's learned a lot from how difficult it was to move salary last offseason and is calibrating roster upgrade expectations, at least in terms of cap expenditure, accordingly.
Yeah, you're 100% right, because he also framed it that way as it related to buyouts, saying, I don't want to be feeling the effects of that pain when we become contenders. So it's not like, let's just get into the playoffs and anything can happen, right? So there is a little bit of a long-term approach, which is good. I mean, it's not, you know, the full-on rebuild approach that maybe some of us would like to see, but within the context of what they've said, it does make sense that he's not jumping the gun to try to do a ton more than he should this year. And you're right. Center is where they're going to go. I think beyond that, the band is going to be back together. Now, if there's a trade that makes sense on the Garland or Besser files, do I think he would make it? I do, but you know, he still talks about hockey trades, and too much of that is salary in, salary out, which wouldn't necessarily help the group because there's not a lot of term left on a Besser deal, right?
So, well, it might actually, like, the one possibility that you may look to do is, sure, it may be outright difficult to just, you know, clear the full freight of, you know, a Besser or Garland, but could you structure deals where with one of those guys, you then acquire, let's say, a defenseman who makes a similar amount of money. And in that case, it's not that you're clearing cap space, but that you're reallocating it to the back end. Does that make sense?
No, for sure. It does. You know, the one interesting piece I'm waiting to see is what happens with Tyler Myers when that $5 million gets paid, right? That it doesn't necessarily affect him from a cap perspective, but it could just in terms of what this looks like. Because if you get, you know, that $5 million is going on their cap regardless, right? So I'm curious to see if they move the player and turn things into a different direction once that happens. We'll see about that. But, you know, it sounds like we heard from Besser, who doesn't want to be traded, right? And we knew he did previously, right? And again, we've always framed this as, this isn't a hard ask, I hate it here. This is a, hey, if it works out, a change of scenery might not be a bad thing. My agent is now allowed to talk and, you know, whatever. And it didn't work out. Now he views the fact, and we know that when the deadline happened, you know, he acknowledged that for the first time in his career, he's felt like this year could be real, right? So we do know, because there were some people out there that just weren't willing to accept the fact that he would welcome a trade, right, at that time of year. And now he even said that it was a blessing in disguise that it didn't happen, right, in that context. But just seeing how the organization views him and his finish to the year is a positive. And for all the talk about summer, I was interested to see just kind of how much Besser got singled out in that conversation.
In sort of what conversation?
Well, like with management, there was an implication about him needing to sacrifice a summer. And certainly, you know, that's a suggestion, an implication that needs to work harder this summer, right? And an acknowledgement that he's been through a lot previously, but whether that's his speed and skating and fitness and all of those things kind of go into that, there seemed to be that in the implication that he needs to give us more this summer.
Yeah, and definitely in terms of changing his offseason preparation, right? He, I think part of his getting back up to speed in the offseason to sort of prepare for the regular season is, of course, playing in the Beauty League, which is, you know, it's not really an intense, fast skating level of hockey, right? And sure, it's good to be on the ice. A lot of NHL players participate in that in that environment. Guys who are local, Nate Schmidt, for example, comes to mind. So it's not, you know, it's not as if it's a joke to be playing in that league or anything. There are benefits to being on the ice, feeling the puck. But for a player like Besser, whose foot speed is more sort of always the concern in terms of getting him back up to playing his best level of hockey once he arrives at training camp and preseason and when the games count. Yeah, I mean, it's probably not the best environment for him to be a part of. And maybe it's not even sort of not playing in that league, but if you're playing in that league, that you can't just look at that as, oh, that's my preparation. If you're playing in that, you still got to put a lot of extra work into your skating, conditioning, all of those other areas that don't get tested as much in some of those, you know, obviously pickup style games. So yeah, I think management was right in terms of, for him to really improve, we need to sort of see, I think, the best version of Besser, even in terms of, I can't remember, you know, what exact year it was, but do you recall the year that he came back and was a little bit too, was it a sophomore year where he came back and he was a little bit too big? It was jacked, right? And it wasn't like he's too big and he's out of shape, but it was like he's jacked, he has too much muscle and that's slowing him down a little bit. So it's been, you know, trial and error in terms of figuring out what is the best approach. And it's critical for Besser because for him, that extra half step, if he can create that with separating himself, that gives him so many more opportunities to get the puck off in the slot. Down the stretch, he did seem to have that extra half step, that extra level of dynamic ability to be able to skate the puck, make plays, and that always makes a world of a difference with his game. So whatever, you know, working with the organization, if it's changing up his training style, changing up what he does in the gym, whatever it is to give him that extra 5% even in terms of his quickness when he comes, if and when he comes back to training camp next season, if the Canucks don't end up moving his contract, that's going to be absolutely critical. And clearly the message has been communicated to him.
Besser gets a C- on Harmon's final grades for the 2022-2023 season. Good article in The Athletic. Take us through what stands out to you as we close out this segment here before we get to Ryan Johnson.
Yeah, and I should clarify with Besser. A lot of people will be like, oh, he's only 2 points off his career high or whatever it was. Why is he minus? Well, he actually had, unfortunately, some of the worst defensive results of all Canucks forwards, right? We've harped on JT Miller a lot, especially in the first half, for not always being up to par in that capacity. Besser's defensive results in terms of goals against, shots against, scoring chances against were even worse. And when you look at how much that Miller line struggled initially, well, Besser was on that line too, and he bears some of that responsibility for how much that line struggled compared to the year previous, where under Bruce, especially in that second half, they were so dominant in being able to control the wall. So that's sort of the explanation there. Outside of that, I mean, we failed Myers and Ekman-Larsson. I don't think that should be too much of a hot take, considering the vast level of drop off we saw. And for this Canucks team to be effective next season, they, you know, OEL doesn't need to come back and be as good as he was, let's say, in his first season as a Canuck. But he's still got to be at least competent, and the hope has to be that hopefully playing with a better partner like Filip Peronik, maybe that can help him sort of take a bit of a step in a bounce back type of way next season.
Yeah, and we did talk to OEL, myself and Patrick Johnson, on Saturday after the player avail, just kind of off to the side, and you know he did say that he just was not in position at the start of the season. His offseason was a virtual write-off, right? Because he was coming off the broken foot at the World Championships and it affected his training to such a degree that when he came in last year, he could skate forward and backwards fine, but any change of direction, having a pivot and do all of those things was a real problem for him. And it showed every time he, you know, tried to defend one-on-one and someone tried to go wide on him. He just simply couldn't pivot and turn. So we will see if we see a level of bounce back. I mean, it can't be worse than it was this year before the injury, right? I do believe there is a little more to give. Now, it's certainly not going to be $7 million worth, but it can be better than it was last year. And whether or not he winds up as the number two left shot D or the number three left shot D, if they can make some moves there, we'll see. But, you know, and you're right. I mean, Filip Peronik carrying the puck and doing some things might help him on a second pair. And I certainly would prefer to see that than seeing Peronik with Hughes. But if you want to get more on Harm's grades, check out The Athletic. It's all there. It's great stuff. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Johnson, GM of the Abbotsford Canucks, will join us as they get set for their opening round playoff series.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Welcome back. Now joined by the man of the hour, the GM of the Abbotsford Canucks. And look, Ryan Johnson, thank you so much for joining us, first of all. And just how excited are you? Because you watched the first two rounds or the first two nights of the NHL playoffs. And certainly there's a lot of angst in Vancouver about no playoffs, but you have them in Abbotsford and can treat all of us.
Yeah, no, I'm extremely excited. It's been a few days of jitters and getting things in place, but I'm excited for coaches and our players who have done an excellent job of through a lot of adversity this season, and And I'm excited for our community, our fans out there, that it really was important for me this season to give our fans an opportunity to watch us play playoff hockey at the Abbotsford Center. We were able to do that with a lot of challenges in place, and just excited to get going tonight.
Let's talk about how this matchup has now changed, because you guys got swept a year ago by Bakersfield, and now you're hosting this, and just how much that changes. You guys didn't face them a lot during the regular season, but just the mindset and the confidence level going into this first-round series this time around.
Well, we've had quite a bit of turnover in our group. I think they're, you know, the nucleus of their group is pretty similar. So they've got a lot of experience there. I think we're going to rely not so much on experience, but the pace that we play with, the passion that we play with, and the fight that these players have shown all season. They just scrap and claw constantly. And anybody who watched that series against Calgary last week, it was playoff hockey, and our guys rose to the occasion. And I'm excited for them to have the opportunity to do that again tonight against a very good Bakersfield team.
RJ, obviously over the last couple of seasons, the organization's been able to move this farm team to Abbotsford. And I'm curious what advantages you've seen for that from a player development standpoint. I'm even thinking of instances when you have players like Nils Höglander and Vasily Podkolzin getting sent down. I'm sure for them, the fact that it's, you know, the farm team's just in Abbotsford and they don't have to move all the way across the continent to Utica, I'm sure that makes the process a lot easier, and especially for those guys, you know, being able to have more of a comfort factor. You know, little things like, you know, when the team may have been in Utica, management might only see you once a year in person because it's so far compared to Abbotsford. Maybe, you know, you feel like you have more resources, more eyes on you. I'm curious what advantages you've seen just in the last couple of years here.
Well, we've been able to, you said it, to be able to use all our resources that we have in the organization, and to readily move them kind of back and forth between Abbotsford and Vancouver has been excellent. And our players have responded really well from that. And knowing that the big brother is just down the road, I think there's also a sense of accountability and guys having to pull their weight in Vancouver. And if not, as you've seen at times this year, we've been able to shuttle guys down the road to get them reps, to get them puck touches. And I think one of the biggest advantages is for our fan base and our community to really, I feel we're a community-owned team out there. And for, as opposed to Utica, where they just heard about players, our fans, they watch this development, they see it, they see the process right in front of them. And then they see a player playing at the Abbotsford Center on a Friday night, Saturday night down arena. It's a really cool experience for them. And they've really had the opportunity to take ownership in that process, which is what we want.
Filip Johansson is obviously coming over after a great year in the SHL. It's a right shot prospect, obviously, that gets fans intrigued and excited. I'm curious, what excites you about him as a player, and what are you expecting from him down the stretch here, sort of acclimating himself with the North American game?
Yeah, really excited about him. Obviously, skates well. He moves pucks. He's a great kid. High compete level, had a great season over there in the SHL. We were able to get him over here, practiced Monday and Tuesday with the team for the first time. And obviously a lot of change, the ice size, a whole new team systems. And so, I think both sides agreed, let's not throw him into a fire right away here, give him a chance to get his feet wet, be around the coaches, get in some practices. And, but, you know, I've told him to prepare to be game ready because we'd like to get him in. And he admittedly also knows that these guys have fought together for 8 months, and to just parachute in and jump into a game one, I think he's excited just to watch and see a game as well. But we're preparing him with the main group as if at some point he's going to play here, and I'll be excited to get him up and going.
I want to ask you about Vasily Podkolzin. So there was a thought originally when we talked to Patrick Alvin on Monday that he had a medical appointment, and the hope is that they were going to be able to get him ready to play for you in this series. Now it sounds like he's not going to be available at all in this series. And there's always kind of been a debate about his desire to play games in Abbotsford, whether it was a year ago when he got dropped in late or this year where he spent, you know, the bulk of his time there before being recalled. So A, from a health perspective, and B, from a desire perspective, what can you tell us about Vasily Podkolzin potentially playing for Abbotsford in these playoffs?
Well, at this point, he's, you know, the health is an issue. I think we're just going to take it kind of day to day here and see where that goes. I know when Vasily came down originally this season, was very respectful to the AHL as a league and realized, I think last year, how difficult the league it is. And so he came down with a fantastic attitude and worked on the things that we wanted to work with him to, at the end of the day, to make him a better player at the NHL level. Got a chance to go up and play, and unfortunately get hurt. But I don't question the desire of him. I do believe that if he was healthy, he would likely be in the fire and go out starting things off in game one with us tonight. In saying that, you know, it's hard, as he did last year, just to drop in for game one. We made the decision not to put Phil DiGiuseppe on waivers and have him come down and join, and there's a purpose to that. I want to dance with the ones that brought us here. I want the guys that fought, scrapped, and clawed all year to get us to this point. I want them to have the opportunity to go and compete tonight and moving forward. And when you parachute guys in, it's hard on the group. That means two guys that have been here and battling come out of the lineup. Usually means some of your young prospects that you've been depending on and giving an opportunity to be in this fire, playoff fire, which is development 101 for these guys. To me, I'm happy with the group we got stepping on the ice tonight. If Vasily ends up becoming an option as the injury heals up, we'll address it at that time. But right now, I'm happy with the group that's going to step on the ice tonight.
What about some of the defensemen? Because you guys had some guys on the back end that were key to your success in the early stages of the season, but then wound up spending extended time in Vancouver. Some of them wound up getting banged up late in the year. So what can you tell us about those guys, the Willanins, the Breezebois, and so many of the others that did get a chance late in the season to play in Vancouver? What can we expect to see from them?
Well, it was great for those guys to not just come up and play, but have an impact, and felt they made us a better team in Vancouver. All of them move pucks well, compete. I think one thing Rick Tocchet was really impressed with was the detail of all those guys when they came up. He felt like they were ready made and did a heck of a job, all of them. And so Breezebois obviously had the injury to finish off, and so did Willanin and Juulsen. Willanin and Juulsen were, you know, key parts to this group here in Abbotsford, not just as players, but also from a leadership standpoint. And the intention from myself, but also from the players, they were adamant that whatever happened to how they finished off Vancouver, that they were going to finish off business with their teammates there in Abbotsford. They'd been with us the entire year to that point. So those two will be in game one tonight, and like I said, it says a lot about our group there when you have players adamant that they go back and finish off business with the group in Abbotsford, how tight that group is. And even Breezebois has been at the facility the last 2 days and around the guys, and you know he's disappointed he can't be putting on the jersey tonight to go at it with them, but be there and cheering the guys along. So it says a lot about how close this group is and the leadership group that kind of holds that standard that we have here every day.
Danila Klimovich had a successful year, ended the season on a bit of a tear, 17 goals on the season, despite, having turned 20 just a few months ago. From the organization's perspective, what's been the approach of taking a young player that has so many raw tools and the approach of trying to round out that player's game without squashing the creativity of the player, and also trying to balance, like, you want to give a young player an opportunity, but it also has to be earned. What's been the approach from that standpoint that has worked here?
Well, it's been a lot of work, I won't lie to you. Danila, you said it, he's got a lot of great tools. The things that we've had to really hone in on with him to get him to the next level is one, just helping him mature as a person and a player. He's very hard on himself. Yeah, I think in the past, a lot has been self-assessment is based off of whether I scored or not. We had to kind of, we've slowly been chipping away at that, getting him to focus on his D-zone awareness, the importance of his wall play in his own end, managing the puck at the defensive and offensive blue lines, and knowing that every time he gets the puck is not an opportunity to toe drag and make a play, that sometimes you got to fight to live another day. And he's slowly embraced that. I think our coaching staff, our development staff, Daniel and Henrik, and have worked tirelessly with him. And I think one of the biggest influences on Danila and a part of his development has been his teammates. I mean, these guys, we talk about it every day, about the quality of teammate you can be to each other every single day you walk in the facility. And I think Danila has embraced that and realized that, hey, I'm managing this game for my teammates, and that's going to give him a chance to use all his tools at the NHL level eventually.
Where do you think Nils Höglander is at in terms of the progress of his game in the AHL and his potential NHL fit for next season? Because it's interesting from a stylistic standpoint with Rick Tocchet obviously coming in. On the one hand, Nils plays this tenacious game where he wins battles and you know, can excel in that north-south style that Tocchet seems to be preaching. But then on the other, his defensive game was, of course, a bit below par in the NHL, and puck management was sometimes a concern. And those are obviously two aspects that Tocchet's really trying to improve on. So I'm fascinated to hear your perspective on how you view his potential NHL fit for next season.
Well, you hit it right on the head. Those are things when Nils came here, it was, okay, hey, it's not going to happen overnight, but these are the details that we are going to implement, and we are going to stress with you every single day and every practice, and that is going to help get you to a point where, you know, he's got a fresh set of eyes probably next training camp with Rick Tocchet. He's got an opportunity to make a real good first impression. But he has bought into that down here. I think week to week, we've seen it slowly improve. And you touched on it, just some D-zone awareness, the wall play, of making sure that every puck up is wall, that it's managed. There's no risk. There's no hoping to the middle of the ice. And he's embraced that. Same with a lot of the ozone entries, where at times I think he made some hope plays or some risky plays that end up going back the other way in the back of the net. He slowly, week to week, has improved on these things. I think he's a much better player now than when he came down and joined us. And I think obviously that was not just physically, but was a mental real hurdle for Nils to get over. The time he has spent in the National Hockey League to now take the step back wasn't easy. His attitude has been great. He's bought into the environment and the players and what our expectation is here every day. And like I said, I think it's going to give him a great opportunity to show here in the playoffs, but moving next year into training camp, a fresh set of eyes and an opportunity to show Rick Tocchet that he can do those things that are important to him as a coach.
Ryan, I want to get into your goaltending first, but I do want to touch on the back end before we get there. And that is, one of the names that really stood out to me in the press conference, you know, we've been kind of waiting for Jet Wu to emerge for a while yet, right? And not everybody's progress is linear. Some take more than others, but it almost felt like this was a really, really critical year. And maybe that's not fair to say, because you see Breezeball and some of these others that have kind of figured it out a little bit later in their career and have been a bit more of a meaningful piece of the organization's future at the big club going forward based on what we're seeing now. And maybe that's the case with Jet Wu, right? Because there was a early on when he first came in, he played a big game coming out of junior and it just took some time. But now on Monday, when we spoke to Patrick Alvin, he seemed pretty bullish on Wu and the season he's had. How much of a step has he taken?
Well, it's been massive. You know, he was one of those players that were affected by the pandemic, in my opinion. Coming in his rookie year at Utica, limited games, just a very different situation. And it was a watered-down AHL, if you recall. It almost gave those guys a false sense of what the American League was. It's like, oh, yeah, this is pretty – this isn't a bad league at all. Well, you were missing – 10 of the best players on that ice in every game. So it was a little bit misleading. Coming into now last year, a ramped up AHL, and I think there was a little bit of trying to find his identity and what his game was going to be at the pro level. And it was talked about a lot with him going into the offseason. And what he's done is, one, I think his conditioning heavily improved, but two, his reads, his attention to his identity. People know when he's on the ice, he's a very physical player for a defenseman. He's almost a throwback that you don't see these days. But if you got your head down in the neutral zone, he's not afraid to catch it. He surfs the middle of the ice as good as anybody I've seen in a long time. And he's been using his skating to get up ice and moving pucks. And just his overall decision-making and execution has improved. And the compete, as you guys know, has always been there. It's just been directing it or harnessing it in the right areas. But what a huge step. And especially with Breezeball and Rathbone, Willan and Juleson and these guys that were up with our group in Vancouver for an extended period of time. Jet really took over that back end and was a huge, huge part of the success that we had down the stretch to be able to secure home ice. So what a great year for him. And I'm excited into looking into next year. At worst case, we get the opportunity to see him play NHL games. At worst case, and I think he's earned that.
Let's talk a bit about your goaltending. And first, the decision as to who's going to start tonight and play in this series, what your expectations are there, if you're able to divulge. But on top of that, you know, there's a lot of excitement around Archer Silovs. And certainly we know Thatcher Demko is the guy here, but Silovs showed well. He's a young prospect, and many people think he's got a chance to be a very good NHL player down the road. And there's a bit of debate about what the best path for him next year is. I mean, this organization can't necessarily invest money in a veteran backup to bring them in. And Patrick Alvin said on Monday, he's not adverse to having a young player like Silovs play here, but certainly a feeling that he needs more games. And then Spencer Martin, who struggled when he was given the ball full time when Thatcher got hurt, but now seems to have found his groove again down in the American Hockey League. So take us through the plan for this series, but also big picture where both these players fit and what you think the right path is in goal.
Well, both players have been excellent for us here down the stretch, and it's been a healthy competition. We essentially have just rotated them night to night down the stretch. It's kept them both fresh. It's kept healthy competition. They've been pushing each other, which is excellent. And right now, that's our plan to go into the playoffs and continue what has worked for us over the last few months, is to keep those guys on a rotation. One's in one night, one's in the next. But Artie, you look at what he has done at 21 years old, 26 wins. Our plan going into the season, I hope to get him at least, 40 to 50 starts. We've accomplished that. Obviously, the starts that he was able to come up in Vancouver and have and do with great success was a huge step for him. He's one guy that I never worry. He's cool as a cucumber. He's got ice in his veins. And people thought, oh, him going up to make an NHL start, I don't know if he's ready for it. I had no question he was ready for it. He approaches, nothing really phases him. He approaches every day just as usual, business-like. And that's what he did when he went up to play in Vancouver. So, I mean, I think we will have a healthy competition, that's for sure, come training camp next year. And if Artie were to force his way in, then so be it. But and Spencer, he alluded to maybe some of the struggles he had when he was given the ball and run with it. But after coming down here, he's got his game back and maybe even has taken another step. He's been outstanding. Again, a player that has faced what he has the last couple of years and really has ran with his model of just controlling what he can control. He came down here, played excellent, great attitude, great teammate, been stopping pucks. So it's certainly a good problem for us to have, having two guys like that that push each other every day in practice, that ding-dong back and forth with starts, and they've been a big part of this success and will be heading into the playoffs as both of them we intend to play.
About a month ago, I had a chance to chat with Pod Colson, and he was sort of reflecting on some of his time in Abbotsford. And it was interesting that he told me that he seemingly was working more and gained more from just the mental side of the game, and even referenced working a lot with the Sedins More than necessarily, even, of course, you know, there were details like wall play, D zone, but he really felt that the mental side of the game was a priority in terms of working on it when he was sent down. Can you expand on maybe what that entailed and how he grew down there from that perspective?
Well, I think the one thing identified with watching him at the NHL level was he played a really safe game, played not to make a mistake, which it usually ended up in his feet planting and analyzing and being on the right side of pucks. And yeah, do we want that? But a main focus of him coming down to Abbotsford was to get him back on his toes, to get him skating, to get him initiating forechecks, contact, not be afraid to anticipate a turnover and take off and create scoring chances that way. So as we moved along, and it took some time, and Jeremy and Daniel and Henrik and all of us talked a lot about him. We didn't want him to play safe. Safe as death. Like, go, get on your toes, take some chances. And as we moved along, he started to really embrace that, and it turned into now creating offense, which I think we have yet to tap into the high side of his scoring abilities. He can shoot the puck harder than anybody, and it just sometimes he's got to be more selfish with it. So when you started seeing him move his feet more, driving wide on defensemen and being not hesitant to use a shot from anywhere, we started to see a different player. And, you know, that was the hope of I felt kind of at the end of the season there in Vancouver before he was hurt. He was getting back a little bit to the safe and not moving his feet. And something we would have really continued to focus had he come down and joined us for the playoffs.
Ryan, we appreciate you spending the time. Last thing I've got to ask you before we go is I want to ask you about Jack Rathbone. And early on, when he was first year under Bruce Boudreau, it didn't really go that well for him. When he came back later in the season, you know, in a bit more of a structured environment here, we seem to see a little bit of the best of Rathbone. And there's certainly some debate about what his fit in the organization is as a left shot D, where Quinn Hughes also is. And they're both somewhat undersized, and we've seen what Quinn's able to do. You know, not many people view Rathbone as a long-term penalty killer, which is going to be so important for someone that's not the number one left shot D here, and what his fit might be long-term in the organization. What have you seen in terms of his improvement this season and where he does fit?
Well, he really has improved. And I think automatically with Jack, people look at they just look at stats and what he was able to do last year. But would you say his numbers in the American League aren't as high? But for me, that's a good thing. That's him focusing on his D zone, he's focusing on protecting the middle of the ice. He's defending better. His details just of his box outs, taking sticks, and has really improved. He's been killing penalties for us down here. And on top of that, has had a fantastic attitude doing it. So when these guys get down here and slowly continue to improve and get better, and Jack knows the focus of his game and the areas that we want to improve on, he's got a great self-assessment. And so he's growing. He's faced a lot of adversity in different situations over the last 2 years. And the kid is tough as nails. He just keeps showing up every day with a smile on his face and going to work. And I think he's looking at these playoffs as an opportunity to take another step and show people that he belongs in the National Hockey League.
Ryan, thanks again so much for doing this. I know it's a busy day. Game one tonight, Wednesday, in Abbotsford. Games 2 and 3. 3, of course, if necessary, is going to be Friday and Sunday again in Abbotsford. Good luck. Hopefully we get you on again later on while you are still playing games in these playoffs.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
That is Ryan Johnson, assistant GM of the Vancouver Canucks, GM of the Abbotsford Canucks. And when we come back, we'll dive into the first couple of days of the NHL playoffs, which have certainly been big fun.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Just want to remind you that my appearance in the VanCast today is brought to you by my good friends at Key West Ford in New Westminster. Check out the Mach-E. I am enjoying every minute of that. And breaking news, Harm, breaking news. The Canucks have signed Elias Pettersson to a 3-year deal. Like, it's big. This is big. And they got him on a real discount because it was actually ELC numbers. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, the other Elias Pettersson.
Well, I mean, the price looks great, but 3 years, I'm sure we would have wanted longer on that.
Well, they burned a couple of years of unrestricted, 1 year of unrestricted free agency.
Yeah, it's interesting.
We got them both signed. They're both Canucks.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that's an incentive for Pettersson now. Is we got the other one in tow now as well. Your twin is with the organization. He's signed. Apply a little bit of pressure there, but it's fascinating the timing of signing him, because I thought that they may bring him over to North America at the end of next season. And look, that could still be the case, right? We saw with Johansson when they signed him to an ELC that they let him go back to the SHL for another season. So it might not change things from that perspective. In fact, now that I really think about it, my guess is he'll still spend next season in the SHL. And that perhaps hints how positively they view his development in the SHL this season. And of course, playing well at the World Juniors as well. And perhaps how confident they are in him as a prospect that at the end of next season, he could be ready to sort of come over, play some games in Abbotsford maybe, and their belief that he's developing on the right path here.
Let's jump into the NHL playoffs. And I'm sure most Canuck fans are not necessarily cheering for the Oilers or the Leafs. I kind of raised my eyebrows a little bit when the Kings wound up coming back to beat Edmonton in overtime. Edmonton has a 3-1 lead in the third period of that game with 8-9 minutes to go. They blow that. But truly, when I look at that game, with Connor McDavid virtually invisible, the Oilers were still the far better team in that game as I saw it. And there's no way he stays like that. Like, as much as Canuck fans might want to see the Kings win, and I'm not sure that there's still a path here. Obviously, that was a big deal. I'm not sure game one road wins are what they used to be, right, in the NHL. And I know you've got some theories on one goal wins that you want to get into. But certainly last night was a little more interesting to me, because if you follow Seattle sports and seeing Seattle beat Colorado in game one as the visitor and full value, that was an impressive result in the franchise's first ever playoff game. And then Winnipeg all over Vegas, 5-1, but the coup de grace, the Toronto Maple Leafs falling 7-3 to Tampa. I can't even begin to hide my pleasure at that.
Oh, I had such a wide smile on my face. There was no chance I was missing this game. I had no idea what to expect, but there was, if there's a chance to see a Leafs playoff meltdown, like, that's appointment viewing, like, that has to happen. Every year, it's got to be on the clock. Set a timer for it, and I mean, if it's going to happen, to see it unfold live, to see them get scored on that quickly, all the preparation and all the hype around this being the year that they can finally get past them, and they're battle tested from Tampa, having faced them last year, and six consecutive first round losses, they finally, even in terms of law of averages, have to figure it out this time. And they know this matchup has been set in stone for months now. For them to have on home ice that type of complete no show performance, that was really tasty. But man, I just hope that Hedman and Chernak come back, because if not, that could really, really change the complexion of the series.
Well, and you know, when you look at this, we all were expecting it to go the other way, because you look at Tampa Bay and they were talking about flipping the switch, and that's easier said than done. Tampa Bay, from February 15th to the end of the season, they were 11-14-1, 91 goals for, 97 goals against. Their penalty killing was around 78%. Then the last 20 road games, 6-13-1, a minus 30 goal differential. Vasilevsky on the road since January 19th, 6-8 with a 3-1-3 goals against. It was, and when you talk to John Cooper, he just said that there just was such little motivation for this team at the end. And they do believe, based on what they've done in the past, that they have the ability to flip the switch. And that absolutely showed in this game. And you're right. They do need to get those two defensemen back, because that could be a game changer. But wow, 7-3, a slapping, an absolute beatdown. And I know in the playoffs, teams have the ability to emotionally reset after a, whether it's a quadruple overtime loss or a blowout like that. You know, I always believe momentum and emotion doesn't carry over from game to game. The resilience level of NHL players in the playoffs has always been remarkable to me. But this Leaf team is fragile, and they're a team that has had no success. And at one point, that's going to break through, but it might not be this time. Just, it's so easy for this team to say, oh, shit, here we go again.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I'm expecting a response from them next game. I mean, I don't think they'll go down this season.
Fingers crossed. You want them to do well? Fingers crossed? Sorry, what's wrong
fingers,
with you?
Like, fingers crossed as in, like, fingers crossed that they don't have that type of response. Sorry, I didn't phrase it right. fingers crossed that it doesn't go that way. But I am sort of expecting that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm expecting it. I'm hoping the response doesn't come. But even though... Here's the thing about the Leafs, right? No matter... You look at all their playoff meltdowns, they've taken it 6 or 7 games, right? They haven't just gotten outright swept and that sort of thing. So I'm expecting this one way or another still be a long series. But hey, we can all hope and pray. I mean, if they go down 2-0, that's a huge hole for them to come back from.
Night 2 was a little different than night 1. We had 3 4 goal victories, one-sided games. Not a single 1 goal game on night 2, but night 1 we had 3 1 goal games, including 2 in overtime, which... Take us through some of your notes, because that tends to be a bit more of the norm.
Yeah, well, I can save some of this for later, just because we've gotten super deep. But just generally speaking, it wasn't necessarily the tight games, but for me, the teams that have been winning so far in these game ones are generally holding their opponents to 2 or fewer goals, right? You look at Carolina 2-1, Boston 3-1, Minnesota 3-2. New York winning 5-1, Winnipeg winning 5-1, Seattle 3-1. Even the Winnipeg game was, it was 3-1, and then Lowry had the empty netter and added another one in garbage time. So the point I'm trying to make is these teams were winning in games where they were able to sort of play a level of lockdown defense, just because the game also changes in the playoffs, right? You look at the New Jersey Devils, for example. I love that team on paper. I think they have such an exciting future. But it is interesting that they were the most dominant rush team in the NHL in the regular season. You watch game one, they had nothing through the middle of the ice. They had no chance to generate anything in the neutral zone. That's what tends to happen in the playoffs with the time and space sort of evaporating. You also look at the Florida Panthers last year, the best rush team in the NHL. We saw how their offense sort of dried up. So the point I'm trying to make is you can have an excellent offensive attack, but you also need the ability to win games where feel comfortable winning a game 3-1, for example, 3-2, 2-1. And that's something that it was interesting. I looked back at, look at the Winnipeg Jets, for example. The Jets, we're not even talking about, in their case, a team that people view as contenders. They won the final wildcard spot, limped into the playoffs. Even them, they had 38 wins this season in which they restricted their opponent to 2 or fewer goals. And you look at how they beat Vegas on the road in game one, it was an ugly, boring sort of victory where they sort of goaded them into playing a lower event style. And that's sometimes how you have to steal a win on the road in the playoffs. So you contrast that, contrast it to the Canucks. They only had 20 wins this season in which they restricted opponents to 2 or fewer goals against. So that's nearly half compared to Winnipeg, a team that barely squeaked into the playoffs. That's a number that has to go way up, not only in terms of them making the playoffs next season, but down the road in the years ahead, 2, 3, 4 years from now. If this Canucks team wants to have any level of success in the playoffs, that's a level of identity that they have to be able to grow within themselves. They can't just rely on, well, if we're going to win, we have to pump 4 or 5 goals against the other team. That's just not going to fly in the playoffs. And I do think that was a fascinating sort of stylistic trend to notice, as we often do in the playoffs. I mean, even Dom Lucician from the Athletic, of course, he had an interesting study when he looked at whether the Oilers were legit contenders or not, and pointed out that, hey, teams all else being similar in terms of talent and rosters on paper, teams that are more offensively oriented don't go as deep as teams that are defensively oriented. Which, of course, we've seen when you have underachievers like, or not underachievers, you have teams that are less talented on paper, like the Islanders, but they were defensively oriented under Barry Trotz's back-to-back Final Four appearances. You even had previous instances of sort of Cinderella teams like the Montreal Canadiens with goaltending and a strong top four, not a great team on paper, but they're defensively stout, and that's how they sort of overperform expectations. You know, that's an interesting sort of trend, and it's something that I think Rick Tocchet is trying to implement and is going to be absolutely critical for both the short and long-term development of this franchise.
And you talked about Edmonton being that team that has improved defensively. Like, that was what I thought gave the Kings a chance in the series because of how good they've been in that end, and the fact that, again, they were able to keep McDavid off the score sheet, still wound up letting him three and need a little bit more than usual for them to pull off the win. Game two in that one goes tonight. Meanwhile, Ron Francis of the 1-0 playoff Seattle Kraken joins Jesse Granger, Mike Russo, and Rob Pizzo this week on the Roundtable. So if you're looking for other podcast options, please make sure you tune into that one. And also U.S. Women's Hockey head coach John Rablewski is Craig Custance and Sean Gentile's guest on the Athletic Hockey Show USA. And as for us, we will be back next week on Monday, so make sure to tune in for that. You can also get a new subscription to The Athletic for just $2 per month for the next 12 months when you visit theathletic.com/vancast. We enjoyed having Ryan Johnson on with us earlier today. Good luck to the Abbotsford Canucks in their playoffs. Harm, have a good weekend, my friend. We will see. Are you going to be in Abbey at all?
Maybe further down. I don't think I'm going to be there for game one, but later in the series, potentially.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get there Friday, so I'm looking forward to that. And we will talk again on Monday, my friend. Have a good weekend.
Cheers, you too.